got 881 mindfulness and 521 the irreverent. Whee! We're on the same page. Literally. Okay, we've got a couple of minutes. So, what we've done here, there are some of the teachings from the Anguttara Nikaya, and I lumped them all together a long time ago because they show from one thing, it causes another thing, from that thing, it causes another thing. And it just shows just how the path works as a sequence. And if the previous factor is not there, then the next factor is not there. So it shows just one thing is necessary before you can experience the next thing. It's something which is very common throughout the Buddhist teachings, like cause and effect, and the effect becomes the cause of the next thing, and so on. But anyway, I shouldn't run forward too much because there's still some people coming in. You know, maybe because of the roadworks at Morley Drive and Compton Street, some people get a bit lost, so we'll give them an extra couple of minutes before we can start today's sutta class. And of course, in 2 weeks' time, it's our Waisak Day, so because it's Waisak Day, that we won't be having a sutta class that day. There's many more activities which we shall be busy with. Okay, I think maybe, let's see, people are coming in here now, so I can begin now. Usually when I give a talk straight from the suttas, usually I do Namo Tassa first of all, just as a mark of respect. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Very good. So at the end of the new translation which I did of the word of the Buddha, there were some more suttas, small ones from the Anguttara Nikaya, which I also translated again. Different than you've seen before. And these are the Anguttara Nikaya, if you have a look through it, is a group of suttas, word of the Buddha, but they are arranged according to some numerical order. So the first one I have here 5:21, irreverent. This means the 21st sutta in the what we call the fives, the group of fives, where they have maybe five hindrances, the five powers, the five indriyas. Anything to do with five is usually put in that group. But also those suttas are very short. And because they're very short, it's wonderful to study them by yourself. But if it comes to a session like this, one sutta is not enough to make a 1 hour or 1 hour 15 minute class all that meaningful. So because of that, we try and get a group of discourses from the Anguttara Nikaya as to make it more interesting. And these particular ones were put together because you always notice that these show this idea of conditionality, of cause and effect, of one thing being the cause of another. And if that first thing is not there, then the second thing cannot arise. And it's almost as if it's beyond your willpower. If those causes aren't there, doesn't matter how much you strive and will and wiggle, that you cannot get that next part of the causal chain. But later on, one of the last in this group here, the very well-known sutta, that even if you don't will, if you don't make this effort, still when one cause is there, the effect will have to happen. So it's cause and effect, not somebody intervening with, similar to the laws of science, laws of physics. Divine intervention or your intervention will not affect the outcome. So first of all, this is irreverent. Meditators, when a meditator is irreverent and undeferential and their behavior is uncongenial to their fellow meditators, it is impossible for them to fulfill the factor of proper conduct. And the idea of irreverent is like unrespectful, not giving weight, or not, because it's garawa, it means like respect to others. It doesn't always mean respect according to their position, how long they've been in the sangha, whether they male, female, whatever. What it really means is you respect one another. So if you come into a hall and there's somebody meditating, doesn't matter who you are, you don't try and make a noise. You respect that they're here peacefully, calmly, and you just try and come in without them knowing that you've come in. So you respect and you revere the fact that they're doing something which is very, very good. And undeferential, obviously, just to defer to those people who now are already here. Don't encroach on their space. This idea of sensitivity to the other is what is really meant here, to be reverent and deferential. Giving up your seat, you know, if that you happen to be healthy and somebody else needs the seat more than you do. So little things like that, just basic etiquette. And then you find if you are not, if you are irreverent and undeferential, then your behavior is uncongenial to your fellow meditators. You know, congeniality, like friendliness, not harming one another by body, speech or mind. And of course, if you don't have that reverence and deference, then you find it's impossible for them to fulfill the factor of proper conduct, which is quite obvious. But when, without fulfilling the factor of proper conduct, it is impossible for them to fulfill the factor of a trainee. And this is what they call, for the monks, it's called the Seka Dhammas. It's the training in, again, just proper respect, eating properly, walking properly, not encroaching on others, being sort of good conduct of yourself, not shouting, not interrupting. This is called proper conduct. And it's proper conduct is pretty easy to understand. Sometimes one just needs to stand back and see other people's conduct, and then you think, oh my goodness, I've done the same, and it doesn't look good. And it's not sort of helpful. It is not sort of something which I like to see in others, and I don't want to see it in myself. So without fulfilling the factor of proper conduct, it's impossible for them to fulfill the factor of a trainee. Without fulfilling the factor of a trainee, it is impossible for them to fulfill virtuous behavior. So virtuous behavior, to be fulfilled, is obviously you have to learn and train. Without fulfilling virtuous behavior, it is impossible for them to fulfill right view. And that is the right view of things like no permanent essence, no self, that suffering in the world of the five senses and delusion, to see actually what's really going on in this world. Without fulfilling right view, it is impossible for them to fulfill jhana, the sama samadhi. Now, it doesn't mean that someone can't get jhana until they've got right view. This means to fulfill sama samadhi, to really fulfill the jhanas, so that one can achieve or enter or disappear into those jhanas, whichever way you wish to describe it, is dependent upon having some right view. And if you don't have the right view, then you find that the jhanas, the sama samadhi, that stillness, have become quite hit and miss, and mostly miss, and very rarely hit, and sometimes hit only by a bit of chance. So the right view is important for the factors of jhanas. And how do you get the right view? By fulfilling the virtuous behavior, first of all. So this is sometimes where the virtuous behavior, the sila, your precepts, that is an important fact, important cause for seeing things according to truth, and also for getting, fulfilling the deep meditations. So, but when a meditator is reverential and deferential, and the behavior is congenial to their fellow meditators, it is possible for them to fulfill the duty of proper conduct. Having fulfilled the duty of proper conduct, it is possible for them to fulfill the duty of a trainee. Having fulfilled the duty of a trainee, it is possible for them to fulfill virtuous behavior. Having fulfilled virtuous behavior, it is possible for them to fulfill right view, and having fulfilled right view, it is possible for them to fulfill the jhanas, the sama samadhi. Sometimes the people meditate just through force, and they finally get frustrated. So instead of using willpower to fulfill jhanas, it comes from right view. Where does right view come from? Virtuous behavior. Where does virtuous behavior come from? Doing the duty of a trainee, proper conduct, and right from the beginning here, being reverential and deferential, and being congenial to your fellow meditators. One thing leading to another. Any questions on that, short sutta? Yes? It is just the fellow meditators, people on the path. In other words, your congeniality to everybody is a task which is almost impossible. Just as the only thing I can remember is that Roosevelt saying, you can please all the people some of the time, some of the people all the time, you can't please all the people all the time. So the congeniality here. Where has meditators, because this sutta was originally given to a community of bhikkhus, monks. So that's why that it was said to, especially to monks. So instead of just having monks, then you say, what about the bhikkhunis? What about those others who are pursuing the path, you know, appropriately, diligently? So that's why I called it meditators. That would say include all of you here, but maybe it wouldn't sort of include, because these are not people who are trying to get to jhanas. Say, I don't know, people of different religions, different faiths, who are really trying to do something totally different. Yes. Okay.
Hi, John. I believe I've heard it said that right view depends on like the words of an Aryan and also the work of the mind.
That is coming in one of the other sequences.
I was just wondering how that fits into this lineage.
Okay, this is comes in because being congenial to others, especially other teachers, means that you know that you tend to hang out with them much more. And because you hang out with them much more, because your congeniality, and because you're deferential and reverent or whatever, and kind to them, that usually just you hear them more, be around with them more. So that's actually how it would work. But those other courses come up in one of the other conditional sequences coming up soon. Yeah.
Ajahn, what is the duty of a trainee?
The duties of a trainee, there are many. They call it Seka Dhamma, which is especially for monastics, there's many duties which you know, we do with just the etiquette of eating, the duties towards teachers, the teachers' duties towards their disciples, their duty to be devoted to solitude, spend as much time as possible. There's many, many duties which we have, and it's not just to our own practice. And the duties to serve others. There was the case, this was from the Vinaya, where obviously many of the duties are expounded at length, where that the monks at one temple in the time of the Buddha made a vow to have silence for the whole 3 months. The 3 months vow of silence. And the people who came to offer dana and listen, ask questions, they were faced with these monks just being quiet all the time, in absolute silence, not even giving a blessing. And so they complained to the Buddha and said, that's not your duty to be silent. You have to serve others as well as having times for quietness for yourself. So it's understanding the duties, you know, which we have as monks and nuns, and the duties which you have, you know, as lay meditators. So we serve one another. But there are many. But I think you can usually understand the purpose of them is, you know, trying not to be self-centered, what's in it for me, to let go by doing kind, beautiful things for others, including yourself. Okay. The next ones. Okay, for mindfulness in the eights. Meditators, when there is no mindfulness and wisdom, and this is the Sati Sampajanya, and in Ajahn Chah, the fourth tradition, he always used to call it Sati Panya, mindfulness and wisdom. You never saw or heard those forest teachers where I grew up and learnt my practice of Buddhist monasticism. I never heard them use mindfulness just by itself. It was always mindfulness and wisdom. And those two words were so twinned that it was impossible in my memory to hear one without the other. So this was always like mindfulness and wisdom. When there is no mindfulness and wisdom, the sense of moral shame and moral dread like their main cause. Moral shame and moral dread is the fact that if one does something which was inappropriate, harms or hurts another person, a person often feels a regret. What did I do that for? Why did I do that? And that type of remorse. Later on in your development, when the sense of self diminishes more and more and more, that lack of shame tends to change into something more. It's not that you're ashamed of your own deeds, it's a shame that you are representing, you know, the Dhamma, representing the Buddha, and you've almost let the team down rather than something by yourself. And the moral dread is, dread is a bit of a harsh word, but it is just the understanding that these actions, bad actions of body speech, do have consequences. And this, oh crikey, that's, I don't want those consequences to cause further problems, either for myself or for others. So that's the idea of moral shame and dread, otherwise known as hiri-otapa. So, when there's no mindfulness and wisdom, then hiri-otapa, this moral shame and dread, lack their main cause. When there's no sense of moral shame and moral dread, restraint of the senses, sense faculties lack its main cause. In other words, anything goes. And it's not the case of, okay, I can do anything because no one is watching me. Now you know that Facebook is watching you. Google is tracking you. So whatever. But without Facebook or Google, at least you're tracking you. You know what you're doing. So this is the sense of the restraint of the sense faculties, like their main cause, when there's no sense of, what are you doing this for? Are you shaming yourself? Or are you really aware of the consequences of your actions? And if you have the sense of that shame and the consequences, then you find that the sense faculties do have a cause. And of course, once you have restraint of the sense faculties, then then the virtuous behavior lack its main cause. So sometimes without that sense restraint, I should explain that in more depth. It is like when you see something in the shops, think, oh, that looks really nice, and the seeing all of its wonderful features and how wonderful that would be, one tends to want to buy it. In other words, the restraint is overtaken by just greed and wanting and ownership. And I can never forget the time, I think the person's not here, thank goodness, when somebody turned up on a Friday afternoon with a TV, a big new LCD, is it LCD, plasma screen TV. Because I've never bought one of these, I'm not quite sure the right terminology, but it's a big TV. And he said, do you want this? And I said, for the temple. And I said, well, we don't want a TV. He said, but it's new. He said, it's new. He said, I just bought it. Well, how can you buy something when you don't want it? Because it was on sale, he said. And that was the first time I couldn't believe that somebody would buy something just because it was a bargain when they didn't need it. Sorry, and to me, I just can't understand that. Maybe I was born in the wrong century. But nevertheless, that when you do have a sense of restraint, then, all your behavior can sort of be a bit more sort of virtuous, kind, simple, frugal, just non-destructive. Because we have a sense of restraint. And then virtue can actually, not harming oneself or others by body, speech or mind. And once, when there's no virtuous behavior, again, the jhana, samasamadhi, the meditation, lacks its main cause. And again, this is emphasizing once again the importance of sila, of virtuous behavior, to get deep meditation. So again, sometimes people say, just go on retreats, many as you can. What they do outside retreats, you know, is not really by any standards all that virtuous. It means you're not going to have all that much success during the retreat. When there is no jhana, the knowledge and vision of things as they really are lacks its main cause. And it's one of the reasons why I put these things down. This is straight, you can check it out for yourself from the suttas. This is just showing that you do need the jhanas to get the real deep insights. You can't just think, okay, I'm going to get real insight without the jhanas. When there is no jhana, the knowledge and vision of things as they really are lacks its main cause. Jhana pachaya yata buddha yana dasana. When there is no knowledge and vision of things as they really are, you don't see things, the truth of nature, then nibbida and fading away lack their main cause. This word nibbida, I never translated it here because there are some words, and obviously the word jhana, I don't think that that has an adequate translation into English. Many people try and it ends up confusing the matter. And so why do we need to change a word which many people who are meditators have heard so often, at least they have an understanding of what it refers to. It's a technical term. So the jhana is necessary to see things as they really are. And when you see things as they really are, then this word nibbida. Nibbida is like turning away. It's a repulsion. It is what I call samsara's ejector seat. So if you can imagine samsara, the wheel of samsara going round and round and round and round and round. Just being equanimous, oh, it's all okay, just means you stay on that wheel as it goes round and round. You're not really attached to the wheel, but you're not pushed off from the wheel. It's like you still keep going round and round with that wheel. You need to press a little button, the ejector seat, to push you off the wheel of samsara. And that ejector seat is nibbida. It is a negative word. It means, this isn't good enough. I don't want to sort of stay around here. This is just more suffering. So, the nibbida button. And from the nibbida, I'm not interested in that anymore. It's not a case of aversion, but a case of, you know, this doesn't make any sense anymore. So that's why you don't get involved in it. You move away from it. And from there, the fading away. The word fading away is called viraga. It can be translated in two ways. Dispassion is one way, but the fading away is certainly a valid translation of viraga. Many sort of Pali scholars agree on that. And in this context, it seems to be the most appropriate. Things fade away. For example, sometimes people get nibbida towards the world. It's really sort of hard to survive. There's always new taxes, new politics, new difficulties just surviving. And you just want to turn away. To turn away in such a way that the things just vanish, you just move away. So your attachments to that part of life fade. And when there is no nibbida and fading away, liberation lacks its main cause. And the simile is another simile here in this sutta. When a tree is deficient in branches and foliage, its new shoots, bark, softwood and heartwood, do not grow to full fullness. So you do need branches and foliage for its new shoots, bark, softwood and heartwood to grow to fullness. And it is interesting that simile of a tree, branches and foliage, shoots, bark, softwood and heartwood, it has actually been used in other contexts where the heartwood is the liberation, the softwood is the jhanas, and the bark is the virtue. You have to go through the virtue, the sila samadhi of the softwood to get to the heartwood. Meditators. Now we have the opposite. When there is mindfulness and wisdom, satipanya, the sense of moral shame and moral dread possess the main cause. You're aware and you're wise and you think, what do I want to do this for? You know, if it's no sense of self, it's not right for the tradition, the path, that you act in such a way, you speak in such a way. And you know there's consequences. Your mindfulness and wisdom. One thing with mindfulness will always also have with it the ability to remember. So I think even in neuroscience, if you're mindful of a particular act or speech, it makes a connection, a neural link. And so the mindfulness is also a way of training and memory as well. It may not be a memory in the sense of memory of what you had for breakfast this morning, but you remember the training, you remember what to do in the same way that your memory of how to drive a car. It's not sort of verbal, it's just automatic now, but you know what to do and when to do it because of the training with mindfulness and wisdom. And there you get the sense of shame and understand the moral consequences of deeds because you've been there, done that, you've understood it. And when there is that moral shame and moral dread, then the restraint of the sense faculties possess their main cause. I don't want to get into this anymore. I've done it so many times. I've been burnt. So that restraint has its cause. And when there's restraint of the sense faculties, then the virtuous behavior has its main cause. And with the virtuous behavior as its main cause, then the great jhanas possess their main cause. When there is a jhana, the knowledge and vision of things as they really are possess their main cause. When there's knowledge and vision of things as they really are, nibbida and fading away possess their main cause. And when there's nibbida and fading away, the liberation possesses its main cause. So when a tree is sufficient in branches and foliage, its new shoots, bark, softwood, and heartwood grow to fullness. So too, when there's mindfulness and wisdom, the liberation possesses its main cause. Questions on that one? You can see in this one, I'll just go back again, the positive one here. When you have one things, then sooner or later, when there's sufficient branches and foliage, of course then the shoots and the bark will actually grow. They don't have to decide to grow. It's cause and effect. When there's a virtuous behavior, then these other things happen in due course. Not straight away, but as the tree develops, it will come to fullness.
So does that mean, like, when it's sustained, so that it's over time these things then become the cause for the next thing? You just do it once or twice, or then you fall off, and then you do it once or twice more.
Indeed. So if it's the simile which they use of a tree is a very good one. You know, that once you have the foliage there, lots of branches, of course, that takes a while, but it's going to happen. The tree's going to grow. And next one here, the delusion. Meditators. Some say that a first beginning of delusion cannot be seen, such that before then there was only wisdom, and after that delusion came to exist. I know that sometimes people say that people are born innocent and saintly, like a young child. But, you know, sometimes that they do carry their past experiences. So the first beginning of delusion cannot be seen, that before then there was only wisdom, and after that delusion came to exist. This is the idea of like beginnings of things. And it's make a point that instead of focusing on the beginning of things, beginning of worlds and planets and stuff, this is more like talking about the beginning of the streams of consciousness, the beings, you know, which inhabit this stuff. So I did always rail against that in science, where they say the beginning of the world. What do you mean the world? Not just the stuff. It's not just who made the car, but you know, where did the drivers come from? You know, the people sitting in the driving seats of stuff. So in Buddhism, they were much more concerned with the beginning of the streams of consciousnesses, which, you know, can take rebirth in so many different forms of existence. One of those forms being, say, this planet Earth. So, some say that the first beginning of delusion cannot be seen, such that before then it was only wisdom and after that delusion came to exist. I say that delusion has a nutriment. Now, the idea of a nutriment, not like a cause, you flip a switch, but a nutriment, food, sustenance, which again reinforces the idea of a general, slow, continuous growth. So, just like a tree has its nutriments, which would be like good soil and water and sun and nothing to disturb it, that delusion or five hindrances, the delusion, this is avijja, seeing things in the wrong way, has its nutriment, and that's the five hindrances. And many of you know the five hindrances, the nivarana, as the wanting in terms of the realm of the five senses, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and skeptical doubt. And just to go a little bit further why not? That when there is a wanting, you see what you want to see. You perceive what you want to see. It distorts sort of perception, which is what we mean by delusion. It's wishful thinking. And the next hindrance, you know, aversion, becomes like denial. You do not want to see what really upsets you, which is scary. And of course, sloth and torpor. That's where the mind is too dull to see clearly. And the next one is restlessness. You're not focused enough. You're just wandering all over the place. You only see fragments of reality rather than staying still long enough to penetrate into it. And a skeptical doubt is again part of, I always call that part of restlessness. Because, no, this can't be right. No, that can't be right. You're interfering. You're restless with things rather than leaving it alone and letting the information just come up to you. So the five hindrances, you can see just how, even in modern psychology, that how they become the nutriment for delusion. And the five hindrances have a nutriment. And that's the three kinds of misconduct, by body, speech and mind. They actually tend to sort of reinforce those hindrances. The three kinds of misconduct have a nutriment, the lack of sense restraint. Lack of sense restraint has a nutriment, lack of mindfulness and wisdom. And it comes a little bit before mindfulness and wisdom. Mindfulness and wisdom has a nutriment, careless attention. So sometimes when people say mindfulness is really important, wisdom is important, yeah, but how do you become mindful? So you have to have careful attention. But why do you have careless attention? It's a lack of faith, a lack of almost like trust. Lack of faith has a nutriment, not hearing the true Dhamma. Not hearing the true Dhamma has a nutriment, not association with good persons. This is sapurisa, which usually refers to people who've seen the Dhamma. Thus, not associating with, it's basically Aryans, becomes full and fills up not hearing the good Dhamma. Not hearing the good Dhamma becomes full, fills up and fills up the lack of faith. Lack of faith becomes full, fills up careless attention. Careless attention becoming full fills up lack of mindfulness and wisdom. Lack of mindfulness and wisdom becomes full, fills up non-restraint of the sense faculties. Non-restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fills up the three kind of misconduct. The three kinds of misconduct becoming four fill up the five hindrances. The five hindrances becoming four fill up delusion. Thus there is nutriment for delusion, and this way it keeps four. Just as when rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountain top, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies and creeks. These becoming four fill up the pools. These becoming four fill up the lakes. These becoming four fill up the streams. These becoming four fill up the rivers, and these becoming four fill up the great ocean. Thus there is nutriment for the great ocean, and in this way it keeps full. So too, not associating with good persons, becoming full fills up not hearing the good Dhamma, so on, and the five hindrances becoming full fill up delusion. Thus there is nutriment for delusion, and in this way it keeps full. And on the opposite, meditators, true knowledge and liberation, enlightenment, has its nutriment, the seven factors of enlightenment. And for those of you, okay, quickly run through seven factors of enlightenment. It's mindfulness, exploring the Dhamma, it's energy, it's joy, it's tranquility, it's stillness, and it is equanimity. Sometimes I don't know about equanimity, sometimes I feel like translating as contentment instead of equanimity. Because sometimes equanimity, people call it indifference. So, and obviously the equanimity, the upeka, literally means just looking on. Now, contentment may be not quite a good word, but it's getting much closer than equanimity, which sometimes people feel is indifferent. So those are the seven factors of enlightenment. They have a nutriment, and that is the satipatthana, the four focuses of mindfulness. The four focuses of mindfulness have a nutriment, the three kinds of good conduct. You have to do the good conduct, first of all. The three kinds of good conduct have a nutriment, restraint of the sense faculties. Restraint of the sense faculties has a nutriment, mindfulness and wisdom. Mindfulness and wisdom have a nutriment, careful attention. Careful attention has a nutriment, some faith. Faith is a nutriment, hearing the true Dhamma. Hearing the true Dhamma has a nutriment, association with good persons. With Aryas, and associated with good persons. Being full fills up hearing the true Dhamma. Hearing the good Dhamma becomes full, fills up faith. Faith becomes full, fills up careful attention. Careful attention becomes full, fills up mindfulness and wisdom. The idea of faith also is inspiration as well. Mindfulness and wisdom becoming full fill up restraint of the sense faculties. Restraint of the sense faculties becoming full fills up the three kinds of good conduct by body, speech and mind. Three kinds of good conduct become full, fill up the four focuses of mindfulness, the satipatthana. And the four focuses of mindfulness becoming full, fill up the seven enlightenment factors. And the seven enlightenment factors, so the seven factors of enlightenment become full, fill up true knowledge and liberation. Then thus there is nutriment for the true knowledge and liberation, this way they become full. And again, similarly, when rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountain top, the water flows down along the slope and fills the clefts, the gullies and creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. These becoming full fill up the great ocean. Thus, there is nutriment for the great ocean, and this way it is full. Causes and effects. So too, association with good persons becoming full fills up here in the good Dhamma to the seven enlightenment factors to true knowledge and liberation. So, questions on that one? Comments? Okay. Have you got there in time? Bonnie, first of all. Is one of the most famous of the cause and effect sequences. You have one? No. Because there's the seven enlightenment factors, this includes the jhanas. These are fulfilling these things. So, further below, this is just one example And there is some of the other examples are coming as well. So these are not contradictory. If you put them all together, you can see this is quite a very simple, consistent practice, which comes up, I think, just at the end of these. And it's the Eightfold Path. So first of all, craving. Meditators. Oh, so I did this one already. Incapable. Is it, am I on 1076 now? Where's the 1076? Is it now? Okay. I think this is the same thing. Okay, this is pretty much the same. So let's go to 1076. Okay. Now this shows the path in the sense of the streamlining and non-returning arahat way of looking at the path to freedom. Meditators, if these three things were not found in the world, the Buddha, the arahat, the perfectly united one, would not arise in the world, and the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by them would not shine in the world. What three? By them, plural. Because there's not just one Buddha, there was many Buddhas. What three? Birth, old age, and death. But because these three things are found in the world, the Buddhas, the Arahats, the perfectly enlightened ones, arise in the world, and the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by them shines in the world. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning birth, old age, and death. What three? Wanting, ill will, and delusion. Lobha, dosa, moha. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning wanting, ill will, and delusion. What three? The view of a permanent essence, doubt, and wrong grasp of rituals and duties. Those are the first three samyojanas, or fetters. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning the view of a permanent essence, doubt, and wrong grasp of rituals and duties. In other words, achieving streamlining. What three? Careless attention, following a wrong path, and mental sluggishness. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning careless attention, following a wrong path, and mental sluggishness. What three? Muddled mindedness, which is weak mindfulness, lack of wisdom, and mental distraction. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning muddled mindedness, lack of wisdom, and mental distraction. What three? Lack of desire to see noble ones, lack of desire to hear the noble Dhamma, and a mind bent on criticism. That's where I always got the fault-finding mind from. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning the lack of desire to see noble ones, lack of desire to hear the noble Dhamma, and a mind bent on criticism. What three? Restlessness, non-restraint, and immorality. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning restlessness, non-restraint, and immorality. What three? Lack of faith, dinginess, and laziness. Without having abandoning these three things, one is incapable of abandoning lack of faith, stinginess, and laziness. What three? Disrespect, being difficult to correct, and bad friendship. Without having abandoned these three things, one is incapable of abandoning disrespect, being difficult to correct, and bad friendship. What three? Moral shamelessness, moral recklessness, and heedlessness. Meditators, one who is morally shameless and morally reckless. Instead of morally dread, I put reckless here instead. This is Hiriyotapa. One who has Hiriyotapa is heedless. One who is heedless is incapable of abandoning disrespect, being difficult to correct, and bad friendship. One who has bad friends is incapable of abandoning lack of faith, dinginess, and laziness. You are influenced by your friends, like in that simile of the elephant which lost his happiness. One who is lazy is incapable of abandoning restlessness, non-restraint, and immorality. The lazy are restless. You think the lazy sleeps all day, but actually it causes more restlessness. One who is immoral is incapable of abandoning lack of desire to see the noble ones, lack of desire to hear the noble Dhamma, and a mind bent on criticism. It's one blames other people, known for one's immorality. One who has a mind bent on criticism is incapable of abandoning muddled mindfulness, lack of wisdom, and mental distraction. One who is mentally distracted is incapable of abandoning careless attention, following the wrong path, and mental sluggishness. One who is mentally sluggish is incapable of abandoning the view of a permanent essence. That's the soul, self, doubt, and the wrong grasp of rituals and duties. Those are the first three fetters. With the not being abandoned means that one hasn't penetrated the Dhamma, one hasn't become a stream winner. One who has doubt is incapable of abandoning wanting, ill will, and delusion. Without abandoning those first three things, you can't abandon the wanting, the ill will, delusion, to become a, first of all, for those first two things, to become a non-returner, and the last one, to become an arahat. Without having abandoned wanting, ill will, and delusion, one is incapable of abandoning birth, old age, and death. So now the positive one here said to reinforce what has already been said. Meditators having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning birth, old age, and death. What three? Having abandoned wanting, ill will, and delusion. Having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning wanting, ill will, and delusion. What three? The view of a permanent essence, doubt, and wrong grasp of rituals and duties. Having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning the view of a permanent essence, doubt, and wrong grasp of rituals and duties. What three? Careless attention, following a wrong path, and mental sluggishness. Having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning careless attention, following a wrong path, and mental sluggishness. What three do you have to abandon those more refined three? Muddled mindfulness, lack of wisdom, and mental distraction. And having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning muddled mindfulness, lack of wisdom, mental distraction. What three? Lack of desire to see noble ones, lack of desire to hear the noble Dhamma, and a mind bent on criticism. It is in places like this that I emphasize that the idea of a transmission, being influenced by others, you can see here that you do need to be around to see and to hear those who have also penetrated the Dhamma in their areas for a person to progress. You do need a sense of a transmission. Having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning lack of desire to see the noble ones, lack of desire to hear the noble Dhamma, and a mind bent on criticism. What three? Restlessness, non-restraint, and immorality. Restless people, no restraint, immoral people, they tend not even to want to come close. Having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning restlessness, non-restraint, and immorality. What three? Lack of faith, stinginess, and laziness. And some inspiration arises when you're generous and not lazy, then you find that one's morality, one's restraint start to improve. Having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning lack of faith, stinginess, and laziness. What's we? Disrespect, being difficult to correct, and bad friendships. Having abandoned these three things, one is capable of abandoning disrespect, being difficult to correct, and bad friendship. What's we? Moral shamelessness, moral recklessness and heedlessness. So in summary, meditators, one who has a sense of moral shame, moral dread is heedful. One who is heedful is capable of abandoning disrespect, being difficult to speak to, and bad friendship. One who has good friends is capable of abandoning lack of faith, stinginess, and laziness. One who is energetic is capable of abandoning restlessness, non-restraint, and morality. One who is virtuous is capable of abandoning lack of desire to see noble ones, to hear the noble Dhamma, and a mind bent on criticism. One whose mind is not bent on criticism is capable of abandoning muddled mindfulness, muddled mindedness, lack of wisdom, mental distraction. One who has an undistracted mind is capable of abandoning careless attention, following a wrong path, and mental sluggishness. One who has an unsluggish mind is capable of abandoning the view of a permanent essence, doubt, and the wrong grasp of rituals and duties. One with a view of a permanent essence, one without the view of a permanent essence, doubt, and wrong grasp of rituals and duties is capable of abandoning wanting, ill will, and delusion. Having abandoned wanting, ill will, and delusion, one is capable of abandoning birth, old age, and death. Questions? Yes.
Arjun, can you please expand on wrong grasp of rituals and duties?
Okay. This is the Silabhata Paramasa. This is, sometimes people say, attachment to rites and rituals, by which they want to abandon all rites and all rituals, even things like paying respect to a Buddha, doing some bowing, or even to, say, offering food at the right time to monks. It's just all rituals, all rites. But, of course, rites and rituals, they do have a meaning to them. Just even just saying Namo Tassa before I started this presentation, it just gets, say, an atmosphere of respect. It's not the rites and rituals are wrong, it's just we want to make sure we understand why we have those rituals, why we have those rites. It is the word sila, bhata, and paramasa. Sila is precepts, it's virtue. So it doesn't mean that we have to abandon all our precepts, all our virtue. We understand just how it works, what actually is virtue. And sometimes that people say, oh, you know that you should never ever, what is it, never ever lie. If you lie, you're a bad person. But then, a lot of times, we know that little story of that wife who told her husband that the man in the next bed having the same operation he was going to have, that his wife, the wife told her husband, oh, your Jack is fine, there's no problem, he survived the operation, because he didn't want her husband to be afraid. And he was going to have the heart bypass, and he came so close to dying. Remember Don? He used to mostly go over to the Armadale group. But anyway, that he was on the edge of life and death, and you know, probably if his wife had told him the truth, he'd probably have killed him. So was it a good thing? Because his wife asked me afterwards, well, I lied to my husband, and she was so upset, she called me directly after she said that to Bodhinyana Monastery. I picked up the voice, I was so distraught, I lied to my husband, first time in 37 years. And then I sort of said afterwards, well, once every 37 years, but no more than that. So it wasn't like a carte blanche. But what it really was the saying that the sila is the old red traffic lights. You're not supposed to go through the red traffic lights. But if I had a heart attack and you were driving me, please go through the red traffic lights if it's safe. And just seconds count. So all precepts. Now the seal, if you understand what they're there for, what's even more powerful than the precepts, then you can actually understand why, if you break a precept, it doesn't mean we don't want to see you in this Buddhist society, West Australia, ever again. You're not excommunicated. There's something much more important. That's why even for monks, if monks break a precept, we have the ways that we just usually acknowledge to another monk. So I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that, but I did it. And so I'll be restrained in the future. And that's it. So that's the right grasp of virtue. We don't abandon it and throw it out and just do whatever we want. In fact, we use it for the purposes of restraint. Uh, Okay, the types of rituals to be avoided. Sometimes I get into trouble with this, but thinking that by just chanting, hour after hour, that's going to get you enlightened. Or excess bowing, 10,000 bows, 100,000 bows, or whatever. Or what other rituals are there? There's so many other rituals which people have, but, you know, are they really part of the path? Sometimes you say no. Yes. Bodwin has a question on some sort of ritual. Is it some ritual? Or even just some of the ways that we have our funeral rituals. And sometimes you have to just praise again Judy Rushforth, who just had such a simple funeral service. That was wonderful. Just her coffin was a cardboard box. And she just did it so beautifully. Really Buddhist. You don't show your love of a person by having an expensive jarrah or mahogany coffin with silk and goodness knows what else. And you show them by just your respect.
Venerable Sir, that's why I appreciate the precepts in Buddhism, is to refrain from rather than thou shalt not, because I think it's more realistic.
Yeah.
And it gives us the opportunity to appreciate that we're only human and we're not all enlightened and we're still on the same path.
Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you could get told off and then thank you very much for letting me know and then just carry on. Don't do it next time. Silly thing. But I wouldn't tell you off for that. So, the wrong course, 10.103. Now this, I flagged this. This is the Eightfold Path. Meditators, and depend upon the wrong course, there is failure, not success. For one of wrong view, wrong motivation originates. And you know motivation is my sort of translation, suggested translation for sankhapa. Usually people call wrong intention, but I think it's motivation. For one of wrong view, wrong motivation originates. For one of wrong motivation, wrong speech originates. From wrong speech, wrong action originates. From wrong action, wrong livelihood originates. From wrong livelihood, wrong endeavor originates. And the endeavor is more like restraining. Wrong endeavor, wrong mindfulness originates. And it is because you're not restraining anything, just the mindfulness doesn't really have the power of restraining the five hindrances, so it is very weak. Remember in the Satipatthana, it's one of the prerequisites of every Satipatthana practice, having restrained the five hindrances. That's the Vinaya Loke Abhijjada Manasang. Usually translated, and I don't know why, because it's such an indefensible, I would say, translation, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. That's indefensible, in my opinion. And having, from wrong mindfulness, for one of wrong mindfulness, wrong stillness originates, the samadhi, meditation. For one of wrong stillness, wrong knowledge originates. For one of wrong knowledge, wrong liberation originates. In this way, in dependence on this wrong course, there is failure. In dependence on the right course is success, not failure. When you have right view, the right motivation originates. When you have the right view, you have the motivation of make peace, be kind, be gentle. Or to be more accurate, the first one should be letting go, renunciation, kindness and gentleness. That comes from right view. From that means you get right motivation. From right motivation, right speech. If it's you're letting go, being kind, being gentle, the speech will be pretty accurate, pretty harmless. From one of right speech, right action originates. One of right action, right livelihood originates. From one of right livelihood, right endeavor originates. Because it all comes from the right motivation of letting go, being kind, being gentle. For one of right endeavor, renunciation, kindness, gentleness, the mindfulness gets very strong. From one of right mindfulness, the jhana sama samadhi originates. From the jhana, right knowledge originates. From one of right knowledge, right liberation originates. In this way, independence on this right core service success. And this was important to me because when I first got hold of the Anguttara Nikaya, reading it in Pali, I was looking, where the heck is the Eightfold Path? I looked in the eights, where I thought it would be. And you can see this is in the tens. Because they have the path, which is the view, motivation, speech, action, livelihood, endeavor, mindfulness, and stillness, samadhi. But they also have, that was the path, and where that path leads to, the destination, if you wish, which is the knowledge, jnana. This is the, you know, the real deep understanding of what's happening, and the liberation which comes from that insight. Now, this is one of my other favorites. For an immoral person, non-regret lacks its main cause. When there is regret, happiness lacks its main cause. When there is no happiness, joy lacks its main cause. When there is no joy, tranquility lacks its main cause. When there is no tranquility, this pleasure, sukha, lacks its main cause. When there is no pleasure, jhana lacks its main cause. When there is no jhana, seeing things as they really are lacks its main cause. And there is no seeing things as they really are, nibbida lacks its main cause. When there is no nibbida, fading away lacks its main cause. And when there is no fading away, liberation lacks its main cause. And again, the simile of the tree. Now, meditators, for a virtuous person, then non-regret possesses its main cause. When you are virtuous, you have no regret at all. When there is no regret, a sense of happiness arises. When there is happiness, joy possesses the main cause. When there is joy, tranquility possesses the main cause. See, from joy is a sense of tranquility. That's bodily and mental tranquility. When there is tranquility, this beautiful pleasure, the sukha, possesses the main cause. And from the pleasure, jhana possesses the main cause. This is where you often hear, well, the monks know this, I quote this so often, sukhino chittang samadhi yati. From sukha, from happiness, the mind attains samadhi, stillness. From pleasure, this beautiful pleasure, this beautiful contentment, the joy you feel even early on in meditation. When there is jhana, seeing things as they really are, possesses its main cause. When there is seeing things as they really are, nibbida possesses main cause. And when there is nibbida, fading away possesses its main cause. When there is fading away, liberation possesses its main cause. And I'm just going to do the last one straight away, because this is one of the ones I'm sure you know by now. I'm sure Ajahn Brahmadi has taught this and I teach this a lot. It's the whole idea of stopping your will and just allowing the process to happen. This is the famous Upanishad Sutta. Meditators, when one is virtuous, one does not need to will, let me be free from regret. It is natural that one who is virtuous becomes free from regret. It's a natural progression without will. When one is free from regret, one does not need to will, let me be happy. It is natural that one who is free from regret becomes happy. When one is happy, one does not need to will, let me be joyful, have this pity. It is natural that one who is virtuous becomes joyful. When one is joyful, one does not need to will, let me be tranquil. It is natural that one who is joyful becomes tranquil. You're sort of content, fulfilled, you're happy, you don't need to do very much. When one is tranquil, one does not need to will, let me feel the mental pleasure of sukha. I made a point here, mental pleasure of sukha. It is natural that one who is tranquil experiences that mental pleasure of sukha. That's, you know, the going out and seeing just all the flowers as if they've been shined up, and seeing sort of the skies is so incredibly beautiful, and this beautiful smells of whatever you manage to comes across your eyes. because your tranquility and the energy which comes from that, you have mental pleasure. And when one experiences mental pleasure, one does not need to will, let me enter jhana. It is natural that one who experiences the mental pleasure enters a jhana. From the happiness, the mental pleasure, the joy. I mean, one of the reasons why every time people says, oh, you get attached to that jhana, please don't listen to that, Gomayang. The Buddha said again and again that mental pleasure is a is the path into the deep meditations. And when one is experiencing jhana, one does not need to will. Let me see things as they really are. You don't have to do vipassana. Vipassana does you. It does you in, literally. So, when the jhana happens, you don't need to will. Let me see things as they really are. It is natural that one who has experienced jhana will see things as they truly are. When one sees things as they really are, one does not need to will. Let me experience nibbana and fading away. It is natural that one who is virtuous experiences nibbana and fading away. And I'll do one little simile here. It was a simile of the one of the similes of a blind man who was. Somebody went to the village and they were setting this wonderful, you might call it, I don't know enough about fashion. They called it Benares cloth, which was the most fashionable and expensive cloth you could get in India at the time. And everyone was buying some, so this blind fellow said, oh yeah, I'll take some too. And the salesperson, being very dodgy and immoral, sort of got out a dirty old rag and said, this is the best of all the cloth which I have. Because you couldn't see it all stained, you know, he got tricked by the salesman and brought it for a lot of money. And a week later, a doctor came through the village, and just like the old Fred Hollows Foundation, and they restored his sight. And as soon as he got his sight back, he saw he'd been sold a dirty old rag, and he was thought it was an expensive cloth. And of course you would get nibbida towards that cloth, throw it away. Because once you see things as they truly are, your eyes are opened, these things which you thought were really wonderful and good fun, because you were mentally blind, you'll throw them away and they'll fade away. So when one experiences nibbida fading away, one does not need to will, let me realize liberation. It is natural that one who experiences nibbana fading away will realize liberation. That is, enlightenment being a natural process. You don't do it. It does you. It happens. So, any questions or comments? Maybe there may be some comments and questions from overseas, because these things are live streamed. And we'll see what we have from overseas. Here we go. Okay. From USA, from Poland, and from nowhere, because they've got a question mark. What is your best advice for a solo practitioner who is unable to get to a sangha to best develop mindfulness and wisdom simultaneously? If you cannot get to a sangha physically, at least you can get to the sangha just on YouTube or on talks or on podcasts. So it's wonderful that you can actually do that these days. When it came to, in the commentaries, when they said, well, what does it really mean to be associate with noble ones? And they said, well, the very minimum, to associate with the suttas, to be able to read them, because those are almost like words of noble ones, words of the Buddha, to really get into those, and that's one of the best things. So if you're a solo practitioner unable to get to a sangha, you know, physically, at least you can get to almost like the echo of the Aryans in the suttas, and maybe later on you can go and find a sangha who... Look, sometimes people say when a... Who was it? Years ago when I went to Singapore, I think Michael Jackson was performing in Singapore, and people were flying all the way from Japan and Hong Kong, and certainly all over from Indonesia to see Michael Jackson in Singapore, and paying a lot of money for that. In other words, they would travel a long distance to see someone who was certainly not an enlightened one. But they would do that because, you know, they thought it was important. So sometimes, if it really, really is important, you know, sometimes you can make the effort, you know, to go and visit people who you have confidence and faith in. Of course, you can't always hang out with them, but at least you can visit them and just get some bit of inspiration. And the next one from Poland is mindfulness, the head's narration saying to do good things. How does it relate to consciousness? Is it a means of thinking things through thoroughly? If mindfulness, the head's narration saying to do good things, I don't quite understand this one. Was it that first thing on mindfulness? Just going through my... Oops. I'm not quite sure, but there was the one which I was called mindfulness 881. When there's no mindfulness and wisdom, the sense of moral shame, moral dread lack their main cause. Is mindfulness the head narration saying to do good things? Okay, how does it relate to consciousness? Is it a means of thinking things through thoroughly? Now, with its mindfulness, mindfulness is just the, you know, basically it's an awareness, has to be with some wisdom, but the mindfulness is actually gathers the information. Sometimes I look at the idea of a experiment in science. You're aware, you gather that information, you find out just how the needles in the measurement apparatus moves this way and that way. You keep taking recordings, but as much as possible, you know, without trying to second guess the results, so that you try and gather the information as objectively as you possibly can. And then once you've got that mindfulness, not thinking things through thoroughly, because thinking things through thoroughly is not really thorough. Thinking usually goes around in circles. But it's getting the information so that, you know, you can just see things deeper than you saw before. Thinking things through thoroughly, using logic and reason, sometimes goes against against what's really out there. So what I think it is important here, to do good things, mindfulness sees what is happening, and it can soon feel that it doesn't matter what other people say, that if you do this, say you take alcohol or drugs, people say, what's wrong with that? You can actually feel it's causing a lot of problems and difficulties, even though all your friends say, oh no, just take it, it's fine, it's no problem at all. You feel from your own awareness that this is something which doesn't feel right. And that not through thinking it through. One of the examples of that, I think I've got a few minutes here, was that somebody told me that there was a TV program about 50 years after the massacre during the Vietnam War of My Lai, where a group of American soldiers were ordered to go into that village and shoot and kill every man, woman and child indiscriminately, no matter who they were. And a journalist saw that, it became big news, and it became a scandal. But 50 years after that, a TV program, it's only anecdotes, I never saw that program myself, they said that one of the people in that military contingent who was supposed to, was ordered into that village to indiscriminately kill men, women and children. One of them was a black African soldier, African-American soldier, and he refused to go in. even though he knew refusing an order during a war would end up in military jail for about 3 or 4 years. And he's willing to take that unfair punishment, in my opinion, because he felt it was wrong. And when he was interviewed, he was not an intellectual. No, his education was minimal. He joined the army just to get out of the ghetto, to get a career, to get a life. And that was the only possibility, prospects for him. But even though he wasn't highly educated, he wasn't religious apparently, but he said, I just could not do that. It was wrong. I felt it was wrong. He did not think it through thoroughly. Because sometimes those thoughts can deceive us. Instead, he felt it, mindfulness and wisdom, far more powerful than thoughts. So anyway, the last question here. How does the Sangha avoid social rigidity or legalistic behavior norms that might itself impinge on enlightenment? That's an interesting question. How does the Sangha avoid social rigidity? Not quite sure in what form social rigidity you mean, but there are times when the social, I don't know if you can even call it hierarchies, the hierarchies, the who's the senior, who's the junior, there are times when that is irrelevant, when monks sit together and we don't know who's senior, who's junior, we're just good friends. And I learned that when I went to visit probably the fiercest of all the monks in Thailand, Ajahn Mahabua. And just after work, all the monks, novices, whoever was there, sit around in the dining shed having a cup of tea. And Ajahn Mahabua would come, and he would take sometimes the lowest seat and just chat as if he was just, you know, just an old friend rather than such a senior teacher. Ajahn Chah would sometimes be the same. So social rigidity, legalistic behavior, the legalistic behavior of monastics, if you have a look at it, has so many loopholes, so many, many ways of you can interpret it this way and interpret it that way. And because of those legalistic loopholes, you know, sometimes it is not sort of hard. In fact, it's not so much legalistic as common sense. For example of that, that, you know, as a monk, you know, you may know this, you've hung around monks for such a long time, the equivalent is for bhikkhunis as well, for nuns. You know, we can't have an interview in private with a member of the opposite gender. So, you know, you may really say, well, I need to talk to you, Ajahn Brahm, in private about this. So imagine if, you know, I went into the closed office with you and talked to you, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, and after that hour you came out with a nice smile on your face, totally innocent, but, you know, because some people have malice in them, unfortunately, that they say, oh yeah, we know what you got up to, in you two over in that room, and there's no way that you can defend yourself. So that's one of the reasons why the Buddha has set up, you know, these legal procedures. You know, monks, you have to be careful. Not everybody has, you know, your best will at heart. So, you know, defend yourself just by making sure you're never alone in uncompromising situations. So, you know, and that means that these days, you know, there is a huge problem, you know, with sexual harassment, people who given opportunities and their defilements take them over and they do some terrible things. So, you know, the legalistic separation, you know, in our Vinaya of Theravada has actually turned out to protect us. And protect us in ways which, you know, at the time I could never imagine. So sometimes it's just being restrained and being cautious. And that's actually just a lot of, you know, what we see, not rigidity or legalistic, but after a while, if you live in a celibate community, those are really required. And it doesn't impinge upon enlightenment at all. It just helps by allowing a person to be apart from things which could give temptations. So one of the other things which I remember learning from Ajahn Mahabodhi, he said, never have expensive things. And if there are expensive things, you know, just in a monastery, just, you know, don't allow people to be tempted. So we do have things like donation boxes, but make sure that they're emptied out or they're locked. Because if you leave money lying around, it's going to tempt someone sooner or later. And he was saying that if you know you'd leave money lying around, you know, it's, you also make bad karma in the sense that you're making it available and tempting sort of other people to break their precepts. So that's, you know, I thought that was an interesting take. That, you know, you close your windows so burglars don't get tempted to come in. We try to do that. We're not always all that good at it, because I do remember that once when I was being driven into, I forget what we were doing, but it wasn't enough time to get back to Bodhinyana Monastery. So a certain person parked the car, parked our monastery vehicle. It was in, I think, not Wellington Street, James Street or something, somewhere in Northbridge, and to go to lunch on the opposite side of the road. And I've been in that place for lunch, opposite side of the road, half an hour, and then the driver said, I can't find the keys. I wonder where the keys are in the car. So, you know, he looked in his pockets and he thought he must have dropped them. So when we went across the road, we found the keys were in the car with the engine running, doors all open for half an hour in Northbridge. We got away with it. I don't know why. That was such a stupid thing to do. But that's, you know, you shouldn't do that, because that's putting temptation in people's way. So anyway, hopefully that answers some of those questions. May not be adequate, because sometimes when you send a message on the internet, sometimes it'd be nice if you can just ask back again, have a bit of a discussion so we really understand just exactly where you were coming from on that question. How does the Sangha avoid social rigidity or legalistic behaviour norms that might itself impinge upon enlightenment? It's a good question, but I don't know exactly if I answered it to your satisfaction. Is there any other questions here? Yeah, John.
Ajahn, just the point about karma. It's always been said that you have to be, you know, fully knowledge of what you're doing before you can make bad karma. But then you just said that if you left money around and someone took it, you're also responsible. So that actually there's two types of ways of making bad karma, isn't there?
Yeah, it's like almost like the bad karma of omission. So, you know, you had no intention to hurt or harm, but, you know, your intention just should be to care. It's not just to hurt or harm. It's the old, like, duty of care, which is very important these days. So, you know, you had no intention to hurt somebody, but you had a duty of care to look after them. So in other words, that, you know, I may leave sort of a piece of toast in the toaster, and, you know, and it wasn't turned off. I never intend to burn down the temple, but my carelessness could do that. So that's why it's for karma. There's also a sense of heedlessness. But yeah, I mean, intention. But intention is also the stupidity that you should have looked after somebody. I should have been careful enough to make sure the toaster was turned off. I didn't burn down the car. You can see the evidence is out there. Okay. So it is 4:30 now. So it's time that we should pack up. And thank you, everybody from overseas, for joining this teaching today, and also for all the mothers. Happy Mother's Day for everybody. Happy Mother's Day.